Hey, welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode we have Mike Hull, Chip Ganassi Racing's Managing Director. That means he oversees essentially everything. Chip's longtime number two, the person who effectively runs the team and has run the team for Chip for 20 plus years. Spoke with Mike a day or two after he got back from France after their big win at Le Mans. Enjoyed our discussion, got into the differences. What was different about going racing in Le Mans compared to years and years of Grand Am and more recently IMSA. His long-held dream, this is something he's been wanting to do, get to Le Mans and race there for Lord knows how long. Spoke about the ACO, dealing with them and their rules, what he liked, mostly what he liked. We also spoke a little bit about the late race controversy, the protests that flew back and forth between Ford and the Ferrari, the Ricci Ferrari team. Shared a little bit about their car being impounded after the race, what they found there. That closes the conversation, which is pretty funny. Shared a little bit about having Sebastian Bourdais in the team. Just a wide variety of stuff. Mike is one of the more enjoyable, more knowledgeable, more insightful, and opinionated folks in both IndyCar and sports car paddocks. So get to listen to him, frankly, just share a little bit of what it was like to achieve a dream first time out and get some additional insights. Love his thoughts as well about his dream future direction of GT racing and whether it needs to lean more towards Ford GT-esque supercars or let's call them lesser grade cars that may be more supercars than hypercars. So off we go with Mike Hull.
I remember a couple of years ago, the delightful Mrs. Hull was telling me how her husband wanted nothing more than to race at Le Mans and more than race, win at Le Mans. And after a long and illustrious career winning Indy 500s, IndyCar championships, Daytona 24 hours, etc., that boy, that might be a crowning career achievement. And maybe then Mike Hull would ride off into the sunset having won all he can win. So I figure maybe let's start this off with a little bit on more of a personal front, and then we'll jump into the team side. But tell me about winning Le Mans on your first attempt, my friend. I know this has been a dream of yours for a really long time.
It has been. We're saddling the horses up right now. well, you know, in the era when I grew up in motor racing, I was a generation behind all those famous guys that got to race every weekend somewhere in the world. It's all you wanted to do to be able to race at places like Le Mans. To be around racing cars and be lucky enough to be on one that had an opportunity to win that race as an American. It's something that people like me from my generation, I think it's what you want to do. I don't know that you ever think you'll have the opportunity in the right way.
Yeah.
So working for Chip over the years has really been good because we've built a team that's allowed us flexibility to be able to do things besides open wheel racing. That's given us opportunity that I don't know if we deserve it or not necessarily, but it's certainly given us terrific opportunity with great partners. Because what Chip does is he put together this network of partners so that people like me can go racing. Just to be able to go to Le Mans and have an opportunity to be competitive there and race there is beyond my expectation.
So what was it like for you getting in after prolonged Texas IndyCar event? What was it like for you getting in and seeing the seeing Le Mans from start to finish almost? I know that you didn't get to see as much of scrutineering as you'd hoped, but obviously you were there last year. You've been there scoping things out, but just give me some of your takeaways of having been there almost start to finish and What stood out?
Ah, well, what didn't stand out was the fact that it was administered truthfully inside the paddock, inside the fence line there, like it is at any other racing event, which I thought was really great. So as a team, and certainly for me individually, I don't think we missed a beat in terms of doing the things that we needed to do to be ready to race. We didn't know what to expect because as a group of people, we had never been there before. There are several that work for us that have, but as a group, we hadn't been. And not knowing what to bring, what to have in the container, what not to have in the container, how to have everybody housed correctly, how to have everybody fed correctly, how to look after the things that come up quickly and efficiently. Those things all fell into place as we went along during the week. In terms of being there, I was impressed with the ACO. I was impressed with the way that they operate. I was impressed with the way that they get everybody through scrutineering. I was impressed with how dedicated they are to having proper race cars on the racetrack. I was absolutely impressed with the race director on the radio for 24 hours. We didn't sleep, running a car. I don't think he slept either.
Yeah.
I mean, just the efficiency of operation to me was terrific. I'd seen a little preview of it a few weeks prior at Spa, and that was one of the reasons that we chose to go over there, was to see how they run a race and see how everything goes and all the rest of that. But it was really good. And from the inside, we were really fortunate because we had George Howard Chappell and Larry Holt, who both have been part of doing races like this for a long, long time. And they were like having, Sherpas, guides, you know. They got us through a lot of things that we wouldn't have been ready to get through. They walked us through all the things we needed to be prepared to do to prepare the cars, have the cars ready, have the right things there, have the right kind of people support in the support roles in the right places. And then as the days went on, they walked us through all the things that we were going to do that we were going to see for the first time. So when you have teammates on the WEC side like that, that are unselfishly willing to help you in every aspect of being ready to race, I think that was that was the unfair advantage almost, you know, because we're a race team, and I think people when we got there forgot that maybe they didn't realize, I'm not sure which it might be, Marshall, that we've practiced winning a lot.
Hmm.
That doesn't mean necessarily that we would go there with a huge ego as winners. It means that we, you know, instinctively, our people know how to get to the end zone. And the thing that really concerned us were the rules of racing. The pit lane, how you do a pit stop, things that the WEC people take for granted. We've never done anything like that before in that fashion. How the slow zones are operated, how the pace cars are operated there. You know, all the little things that go on, what you can and cannot do when your car stops in the pit box. You have to put it on that in the air and on that little trolley and roll it back in the garage to do work. You know, whereas in an IMSA pit lane, we take it for granted that we can do work on the car.
Yeah.
So it's just all of those things. We thought we were going to get caught out by that, and we did. The 60, the car that won the race had to do a drive through. And it was the having the car running in the air thing, but it was actually a malfunction. It wasn't really because we made a mistake. We had to change the steering wheel, I think, as I recall, and keep going there.
Yeah.
But, those were the things that we were concerned about. But, you know, sitting down with George in particular, you know, he really helped us get through all of that, understand all of that, be ready and prepared for that. I think that was, you know, that's like having a technical advisor with you, right? We had one right next door, that was really, really great. And then I would say that maybe the Ford guys, the enthusiasm they have for racing is extraordinary. They aren't, you know, they're a guided missile in the right direction. They have so much energy behind them and so much resource behind them that anything that we need or needed or anything we needed there, those guys just stepped up to the plate for us. It just made our jobs as racing people a lot easier.
So we get into practice, and it's apparent right away that the Fords are absolute rockets.
Yeah.
Were you surprised at the pace advantage that the four GTs had? And I ask that in the context of you're accustomed to, and you know, I'm accustomed to an IMSA, for example, whether it's a Rolex 24 or Long Beach, doesn't matter where. It's fairly rare in GT racing where any manufacturer is particular, like really stand out strong at a big event. This to me was something where it seemed like from the outset that, wow, the Fords going into practice in the first rounds of qualifying, there was some serious, serious speed that the others could not muster. Was that a surprise to you guys?
I didn't know what to expect. And I think as a team, we really didn't know what to expect because we started to come into our own as a team on the North American side. We started to come into to our own as a team at Laguna Seca.
Mm.
And what that means is that most of the misfortune and a lot of the ills that we had had, we solved most all of them. You know, this was such a steep learning curve for a team and such an alpine climb. In terms of getting the car, a brand new car like this, the complexity of this car, right. And it took us until Laguna Seca to have cars that we felt confident on the grid were going to run trouble-free for an entire race distance, and they did. But that doesn't mean necessarily that we could predict the speed of the car when we went to Le Mans. We had no idea, Marshall. But I've thought about it since we left there, more so than while I was there. And kind of reflected on it a bit. I'm not sure what we did actually says, because I consider this car to be a supercar in terms of the design and development.
Yeah.
That races inside this category. And I don't know if this now puts the flag up in the air for the other manufacturers to create a supercar to race at Le Mans that will race at the other racetracks, because I think that's what this car actually is. It's a terrific car in the GTE Pro category in Europe and the GTLM category in North America that races well on a racetrack like Le Mans. Was designed to race there, let's face it.
Yeah.
Was designed to get through the transitional loading of a chicane without losing speed. And take advantage of the aero for the straightaways. I don't know how you BOP that. To be honest about it.
Yeah, because I mean, if you look at an Aston Martin V8 Vantage, or if you look, and you and I spoke about this, I think Friday maybe, after the BOP change came down. If you look at an Aston Martin Vantage V8, beautiful car, love it.
Yeah.
You look at a Porsche 911 RSR, beautiful car, love it. You look at a Ford GT. If we're playing the old, which one of these is unlike the other, everyone's going to point to the Ford because that thing looks like it was built by NASA to go into outer space, and the other two look like, you know, beautiful cars you'd take your date out to have dinner with and impress your date with, but one is definitely, you know, from another galaxy, and the rest of the cars in the class, without a doubt, look, they're what we have known as GT race cars for quite some time, but no argument in the fact that you look at the Ford GT, and for me at least, I've been asking the same question. Do we, you know, should this class evolve towards hypercars, which the Ford GT would certainly fit within, or is the Ford, you know, if they want to maintain the standard of the class, does that then make the Ford the odd car out? And
I don't know. It's called Pro. It's called Pro, isn't it? And I think that it does from the inside out, it does reflect the individual technology of a company, of a corporation. It's a showcase place for Ford's technology. Not just the aero technology, but in this case, the EcoBoost technology. You know, we have an engine that architecturally 70% of the engine is what you get in a streetcar.
Yeah.
You know, it just has the only items that it does have are durability items, so that it'll run for a 24-hour race in this case. There's a lot of their technology in this race car that they use for street vehicle performance and durability items and fuel economy. And that's truly what this is all about. Personally, you know, I dislike the fact that somebody has to regulate how fast you go. I personally dislike somebody saying how much fuel you can put in the car, how much fuel you can use, how many laps you have to go on the racetrack, how long you have to stay plugged in with the fuel. I don't know how it's gotten to this point, but it has. I don't speak for the manufacturers. I speak for the race team. You know, we go for the jugular when we race, let's face it.
Yeah.
That's what we do best. If we had our way, the rule book would be, you know, two pages. You know, it'd be a wheelbase track, overall length of the bodywork, and the displacement size of the engine, and I would control the rules by fuel usage, and that'd be it. You know, other than that, but it's not that way. But I think this category needs to be a category that is at the highest level to represent its company's technology. I'm a little frightened about what may come next in terms of the other manufacturers, because they've peeked at what this technology is. We're going to race with this technology for a while. We may get our doors blown off next year.
Yeah.
And rightfully so, because I think that's what this category should be all about.
The stuff that went on late in the race with the protests and whatnot, that's all behind us. That's been put behind us. But I know that, you know, would it be safe to assume that those decisions, those things happened at a layer above the team in the garage, physically running the cars and focusing on winning the race? Is that would that be a safe assumption? That was kind of above your and everyone else's proverbial pay grade.
You could make that assumption easily, I suppose. Based on the what I liked about what happened as a result of the protesting that did happen was the fact that the ACO officials looked at it and they created a practical solution. And, you know, I think they take a bad rap for being impractical sometimes. You know, just by what I read, right, and what you see, and the people say, "Oh my God, they're going to be so difficult to deal with, and you're going to hate life, you're going to do this, that, and the other thing," right? And the absolute opposite happened there. So I think that no matter how the protest or protests were fired off between the two teams, the ACO acted like King Solomon and figured it out. I think that was terrific. I think that's terrific.
The race itself was not exactly trouble-free for you guys. Tell me a little bit about the race starting off with a rather bizarre sequence of seeing one of the four GTs thrown up on the dollies and wheeled back into the garage.
Yeah. You know, yeah, they had an issue with the electronic or the servo side of the shift mechanism, and that put them down several laps. They recovered in the sense that they got running after that and ran the whole race, the race distance. But it certainly took one car out of the rotation. Let's face it, the reason that you run multiple cars there is to have one of them at the front at the end of the race, which did happen. So when one falls to the wayside there early on, it just, all the hard work, everything that everybody does, you know, it's just, all the air comes out of your lungs, and you have a tough time finding how to inhale again.
Yeah.
It was difficult. It wasn't expected. It just happened, unfortunately. But the guys jumped right on it, fixed it, and got back on the racetrack.
Bounce around a couple final items, Mike. So ACO came back with some BOP adjustments on Friday. Chip sent out a tweet to myself and I think Dutch Mandel about calm down about all this BOP stuff.
Yeah, because Chip and I were talking about it. He says, man, can you believe how, I don't remember what the word was, but like the tone of all these people, like it's the end of the world. Do they realize we're still going to race?
What I thought was
came down with a correction, and I think that they did what they thought was the right thing to do, but they didn't just throw Jell-O at the wall and hope that it sticked. I mean, they looked at quite a bit of information from the racetrack with all the timelines there, and made a decision to try to equalize the competition a bit more than where they thought it was. And that's their right to do that. And you know what our right is? Is to accept it immediately. The faster we accept what the rulemakers do to us as a race team or how they try to change the way that we've practiced to be ready for the race, the more prepared we're going to be when the race starts. What I dislike are people that potentially could work for you that want to spend all their time not figuring out how to be better with where you presently are.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Chip was probably trying to say when he sent that tweet out, or he sent I don't know what he sent to you, but
yeah,
whatever it was.
No. What I thought was cute about it, and that's how I received it, was it was a perfect comment from Chip for someone who's never raced at Le Mans as an entrant. Because, you know, to me, that tweet, again, it's totally meaningless. I just had a little giggle at it because if he'd been there 5 or 10 times as an entrant, he would have realized that this doesn't really happen. Like, this is a pretty big precedent that's being set. Not that this is the first time BOP change has happened, at, you know, 24 hours before the race, but really, to me, is the first time I can recall there are sweeping changes throughout an entire class. So, again, I think the part that Chip didn't understand, just due to a lack of experience there as an entrant, was this was actually a pretty big deal. And it wasn't just specifically aimed at Ford. Every car receive some form of change, and there were, you did see that there was some effect in the race. I mean, you guys lost about half the pace. Some other cars picked up speed, so I mean, it had some of the desired effect. But anyways, I just thought that was kind of funny. Like, all right, buddy, you don't realize that this is big news. It's not people just blowing something out of proportion. But you know, anyways, if Chip wasn't Chip, the world wouldn't be right. So I had a good laugh at it.
No, that's probably true.
So three American flags flying over the podium. Tell me about seeing that. Tell me about you know, thoughts on achieving this result. You've spent quite some time working towards, and then maybe also tell me a little bit about the folks standing up on the podium representing you. Joey Hand, who was brought in, who wasn't unknown to the team, but you guys placed a lot of faith in Joey becoming a team leader. Dixie, his first time there. Dirk Mueller, who, new to the team, but an absolute rock star. One of your arch rivals in IndyCar, Sebastian Bourdais, becoming a first-time winner at his home race, and on. I mean, I don't know, brother. It seems like there's a lot of stories packed into that podium.
There are a lot of stories there. Yeah. First of all, in terms of Bourdais, any guy that can ride his scooter back and forth to work is from his house is a guy you want to have on your side in France.
And what did you learn about working? I mean, it's not as if Le Mans was your first event working with him, but having had him as in the team and really seeing, you know, getting the full experience with Seb over quite some period of time. I don't know. I look at him and say, boy, if a IndyCar seat ever opens up or whatever, I gotta believe he more than impressed you guys in general.
Well, I can't remember where he tested the car the first time. Over the winter, I was there. I don't remember where it was. I don't think it was Super. It might have been Homestead. On the road track, he showed up and did half a day or something in the car there. But it was one of those weeks when we were there for like 3 or 4 days. He doesn't mince words. And he doesn't worry about feelings. Okay, feelings, you know, like there's a song about feelings, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Feelings to him are not really important. I don't want to say that in a negative way.
No, he's results driven.
What I'm saying is he gets right to the heart of it, right to the point of it about the car. He tells you exactly what the car needs. Now, you got these guys that have spent laborious hours as engineers, hours as technicians, hours as support guys, hours as vendors. He tells everybody exactly where their car is. Exactly where it is. He says it in such a way to where it whether it's right or wrong, you know where he stands. And I love that.
Yeah.
I love the fact that the guy comes right out and says, hey, if you want your car to be faster, it's got to do this. These brakes suck. Okay, basically. Or I don't like this particular item on the car. If I could sit like this in the car, it would just be more comfortable for a 24-hour race. You know, it's just all these small things that offend certain people who have spent countless hours trying to do what they think is right. And he comes right in there and says, he just talks about how to make it better. Then on the racetrack, no matter what he's talked about, he gets it done. If he doesn't like something on the car, he gets it done. If he likes it, he gets it done. When it comes to driving the car, he drives the car. The fact that he had driven there, 11 times prior or 12, whatever it was, I don't think that hurts you. The fact that he rode his scooter back and forth to work from his house to the track, I don't think I like having a local guy drive a car anytime there. I found that out. That's really good. I asked him if he had any neighbors. The other two drivers, we chose Joey, you know, Joey drove for us, while he was still a BMW driver, when he was in Europe, drove at Daytona for us, and we saw how special he was, and how unselfish he is as a teammate. And, you know, if you looked up the word teammate in the dictionary, his picture would certainly be there. And he's got an enormous ability. We didn't choose him because he was an American. We chose him because he's a teammate.
Yeah.
And he has ability. That's how we chose every driver on the team. Dirk Mueller is so into everything that's going on with the car. Every little detail, everything that makes it work. His confidence level increases as he understands more and more and more about what goes on with the car and his teammates. He, again, is very, very unselfish. In fact, when we chose the drivers to drive, we had a lot of choices, and I know we did disappoint some people when they weren't hired. But what's in common with the people that are driving our cars in either of the WEC series or the IMSA series for that matter is exactly that. In their career, that's how they presented themselves.
Yeah.
And that's how they lived their lives out of the car and in the car.
Sure.
All three of those drivers in that 68 car display all of those attributes as being a teammate.
What about seeing your boy Dixie up on the podium as well? And that's not to discount Westy or Ryan, but you and Dixie have been on a decade-plus journey.
I just think that he is, to me, having been around him now and continue to being around him, and growing up watching guys race in a different era than this one. He's a throwback guy in today's times. He's a guy that could race Formula 5000 one weekend, Can-Am the next, IndyCar the next, Trans Am the next, stock car the next, Formula One car the next weekend. He's one of those kind of guys. And I have so much respect for how he conducts himself in and out of the race car to get the most out of the race car. It comes with seeing him up close with his drive style and how he continues to change it as the tires degrade in whatever car he's driving. How he listens to his teammates, but he gives more than equal back to his teammates while he's listening and learning from them.
Mm.
Doesn't try to just to understand how he can be better. He tries to understand how everybody can be better and faster. I wasn't surprised that he was on the podium, to be honest about it, because I thought if we had our way, he'd be up there. I just have respect for him. And the two teammates together are amazing together.
Pretty wicked.
They are so good together. And Dixon just falls in with those guys like they've been together for years. I didn't know Richard Westbrook at all I sat down with him. And the first time I sat down with him and looked him in the eye and talked to him, I said, Chip, I met with him at Road Atlanta. And we were to the point, I think we had one driver left to choose. And we were having a tough time and all that. And he had somebody in common, a good friend of mine, call me and said, you should really sit down and talk to Richard Westbrook. And I said, okay. I sat down and I spent several minutes, I don't know, probably a half hour, 45 minutes with him, talked to him. That was before Chip arrived at the racetrack, and I said to Chip, I said, when you get here, we got to sit down with this guy. He said, why? I said, I think this is our kind of guy. And he came in and sat down with Chip, and we spent several minutes with Richard, and Richard left, and Chip said, why haven't you hired him yet? we just have really, really good people as teammates. And when you have that, you can achieve so much more every day. When you're not having to separate them with a stick every 5 minutes.
Sure.
It makes such a difference. It makes such a difference. You know, and for me personally, going to Le Mans as an American, understanding that what it means to represent how we race in the United States and our race team, Chip Ganassi Racing, and see those flags up there and the anthem and all the rest of that, that's really, really special stuff.
And you also told me you and the team visited Normandy as well, which I know you said was very moving.
Oh, my God. You know, the first day, that's something I've always wanted to do. And the very first day after flying overnight and all the rest of that shit from Texas, we got in the car and went straight up there. And I was in awe of what – it wasn't just Americans that landed at Normandy.
No.
You know, it was Canadians and British people, English people too. But just – the obstacle course that they had to run through to get from the boat to the beach, let alone get on the beach and then get past the beach, to see that firsthand, to go to that cemetery and not be able to see the end of it.
Brutal.
And there's 9,000 people buried there. To see the cliffs that the thing the Rangers went up, those cliffs between Omaha and Utah Beach, they had to go up there to try to get those gun emplacements out. 270 guys at the bottom, 90 made it to the top, 45 made it 400 yards 2 days later.
Jesus.
to, you know, in America, all that stuff would be roped off. Over there, you could just go check it all out, you know. If you don't understand the gravity of what those guys did for what we do today, the freedom we have today, I mean, I'm disappointed you can't transplant that so everybody in America can see it firsthand.
Yeah.
What an amazing thing. Yeah.
Well,
I mean, the beach itself there, you know, the reason they waited for the tide, you know, to be all the way out at its furthest point on that day in June was in order, you can see it when you see it firsthand, in order to get all the manpower and the equipment on the beach, the tide had to be all the way out. Because they weren't just going to march on the beach and march inland. Because the bluffs that are above Omaha Beach, Juneau and Sword Beach there, there's the direct line of fire from all those tops of those hills right into the guys that are running onto the beach. So,
yeah.
Man, it was impressive as hell.
So I heard a rumor that there might have been a clause in the agreement that said if you guys won, that would add on two more years of competition for the 2-year Ford program. You tell me anything about that, Mike? Because, you know, can't tell me you guys are going to pack up after next year. Come on, man. You started
well,
a pretty
you know,
good story.
You know how Chip Ganassi Racing is. We never talk about contracts.
Of course. Well, then, a better one, then. So, if you were planning to visit Normandy again, would you think you might have one more opportunity or three more opportunities? How that? Nothing about contracts.
Well, I hope that by winning this early, that we have an opportunity to continue going to Le Mans for several years. But I hope that's the case, because what this program did before we got to Le Mans was it has engaged Ford globally. I don't know that I realized truly until I was at Le Mans the passion that the Ford family themselves have for their product. And in this case, the representation of their product in motorsports. There were a lot of people there whose last name was Ford.
Yeah.
They were really into, not only after the race, but well before, everything that was going on. And not, you know, not the pageantry, just the mere fact that they were represented there in the manner that they were. I hope we can represent them in that manner for a long, long time in sports car racing, because it's really gratifying to win for people like that. Gratifying is not the right word. It's really special and heartfelt to win for a family like that. It was, you know, just to see the look on their face as to what it meant to them personally was worth the plane ride in each direction.
I guess the last question for you, any reprimands or fines for Bourdais for blasting champagne up William Ford's nose on the podium?
You know what? I think he probably would do it again. You know, I'm talking about both of them. If we're lucky enough to be on the podium again like that, I think they'll stand in line to be able to do that.
Amen.
Let's face it, that was started by an American in 1967, and their tradition still carries on.
Amen to that. Very fitting.
You know, one little note that I thought was really funny was when the race was over and the car that won the race was an impound. The scrutineers were kind of going through the car, whatever they do, and Tyler, the chief mechanic's down there with the car along with the guys, and they go to him after an hour or so of being in scrutineering, well after the race, by the time the car there is and all that, they said to him, okay, we're going to go home now, and we'll be back tomorrow. And we're not sure how long we're going to need to go through the car, but it'll probably take us most of tomorrow. And Tyler said, "Wait a minute. What? Where are you going?" I said, "Oh, we're going home." He said, "Well, you can't go home. We have to pack. We have to load the car tomorrow. It has to fly back to America. We have a race in 2 weeks." They said, "No, you don't understand. You've earned the privilege to stay with us for up to 2 weeks."
Wow.
And they left. They just walked away. Tyler comes back down looking for Mike, like, Mike, we got to go down there. They want to keep the car for like 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
So Mike went down there the next morning. Got more organized, but I thought it was funny.
Oh, we're just going to hold on. We're going to borrow your car for...
yeah, you. That's a privilege for you to be here.
Wow.
And that was Mike Hull. Thanks for listening in. Check out more podcasts and other content at MarshallPruitt.com.